Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, standing in the lobby of the Hart Senate Office Building on Capitol Hill, where I sat down for a lengthy conversation with U.S. Senator John Cornyn. I asked him about the bill he co-authored with Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer, calling for Americans affected by 9/11 to be allowed to sue the Saudi government, about the state of the Republican Party, and I asked him about his relationship to Senator Ted Cruz. Senator Cornyn, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
You co-authored a bill with Senator Chuck Schumer, the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, to allow Americans affected by 9/11 to sue Saudi Arabia for damages. What evidence convinced you that the Saudi government was somehow complicit in those acts of terrorism?
Well, the bill isn't specifically addressing Saudi Arabia, but as you know, there's 28 pages left out of the 9/11 report, which the president now says he will likely release, which allegedly implicate some individuals in the Saudi government. This bill would amend a 1976 statute called the Foreign Sovereignty Act, what it would do is specifically remove the requirement that it be a state-sponsored country from a state-sponsor of terrorism. For example, Iran, you may have seen recently, there was $2 billion judgment upheld by the Supreme Court, but they've been designated by the Department of State as a state sponsor of international terrorism. So what this would do would be to remove that requirement so it would be more broadly applicable against terrorist activities, and it also is limited to terrorist activities that occur on American soil. So it's actually pretty narrow. But it could, if the facts lead in that direction, affect some people in Saudi Arabia. There's no denying that.
The president has said he would veto the bill if it passes. He went to Saudi Arabia last week to try to sue the ruffled feathers. How much does it matter if the passage of this bill, if it happens, disrupts diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think the claim that it will disrupt that relationship is overrated. What really disrupted the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia was the Iranian nuclear deal, which the Saudis justly, in my view, felt like provided an existential threat to them. The idea that Iran would at some point develop nuclear weapons and that would be okay with the world community, even though they are a state sponsor of international terrorism. So this, I don't believe, is going to change that relationship. I do believe that justice for the victims of 9/11 is important. And I do believe that this would provide an opportunity for them to seek justice and would not irreparably harm this relationship.
If the Saudis divest themselves of $750 billion in U.S. assets, as they've said they would do, what would be the economic impact on the United States?
Well, I think you have to doubt. I doubt whether they would divest themselves of their holdings in the United States, because essentially what they would do is drive their own bond prices down and hurt themselves in the process. I think it's a hollow threat, and I don't think that if they did sell off some of their bonds, I don't think it would have a negative impact on the U.S. economy. I think it would be relatively insignificant.
Any concerns that other countries would pass legislation, some say in retaliation, to match what the U.S. would do with this?
Well, I mentioned a moment ago that this legislation is actually is part of the Foreign Sovereignties Immunities Act. It would amend a 1976 statute. So what I'm suggesting has really already been the law of the land, not as presently proposed, but the whole idea of, in some narrow circumstances, sovereign immunity of other countries would not be honored, has not led to this parade of horribles that some of the critics have claimed, and I don't think this would either.
You have said that you think the next president should be the one to fill the vacancy left on the Supreme Court by the death of Justice Scalia. Why?
Well, part of it is because the judicial confirmation process has become hopelessly politicized over the last few years. You may recall that even when Clarence Thomas was confirmed to the United States Supreme Court, he actually was confirmed with 52 votes. It was only when George W. Bush became president that my Democratic friends said that 40 senators could essentially deny, or 41 deny, a presidential appointee. In other words, they could filibuster those nominees. And there's been a series of comments by Joe Biden, Harry Reid, Chuck Schumer, leading me to believe that if the shoe were on the other foot, they would have done the same thing. I would say that it's not an unreasonable position, in my view, to say that the voters who are choosing the next president should be the one to make that decision. I can understand the president doesn't like it. The Constitution does give him the authority to make the nomination, but it gives the Senate the unilateral authority to either grant or withhold consent. And in this case, we've said that we are going to withhold consent. We'll see how it all turns out after the election. There may be some that say, well, this proved to be a good idea, and others to say, well, maybe it wasn't so good.
There are people who argue that the voters had their say when they elected President Obama for a second term.
I've read that. I would say to them that the voters also had their say when they elected a Republican majority in the Senate in 2014, recognizing that I think that was an expression that the voters wanted a check on presidential power by the president. And this is one way to provide that.
Do you think future presidents should commit to not filling vacancies in the final years of their terms if they come up unexpectedly?
I think this will change the debate. I would hope that we could somehow declare a truce and say, let's return to the good old days when nominees were processed without the hyper-politicalization. But I don't see that happening anytime soon. So I think as a practical matter, what this will do is set a precedent that will make it difficult, absent a negotiated resolution, to fill those vacancies occurring late in the president's term.
Primary season is always fractious for both parties. Are you concerned this year about the divisions you're seeing within the Republican Party?
Well, it's unprecedented in my experience. Used to be in the Republican Party, the arguments were more about who was the true conservative and who was not, and at least of late. And now with Mr. Trump's entry into the presidential primary, it's more of a populist, not an ideological message. I would say that it's not just in the Republican primary, it's also in the Democratic primary, as exemplified by Bernie Sanders. And I think been quite a surprise to Mrs. Clinton, who thought she was going to win that nomination without much of a fight. I'm not pessimistic. I'm not despairing. I think, you know, self-government is kind of a messy business, and this has proven to be messier than many people would have thought. But I think it also reflects the level of frustration people feel at the status quo and the inability of the two major political parties to basically solve some of our biggest problems. And this is definitely changing the terms of the debate and discussion.
Do you consider Donald Trump a Republican?
If he considers himself a Republican, I consider him a Republican. That's really a broad spectrum. Yes, if he does, I do. And I'll support the nominee of the party, including if he's the nominee.
We heard the announcement very recently that Senator Cruz and Governor Kasich are going to combine forces to try and stop the momentum that Donald Trump has toward the nomination. Can they stop him?
I don't know the answer to that, but what it tells me is that they're worried about him getting to 1237, either on the first ballot or thereafter. I heard Senator Cruz say that neither he nor Mr. Trump could get to 1237 on the first or second ballot. What this tells me is that Senator Cruz and Governor Kasich just feel like they're teaming up together, have a better chance to push this to the multiple ballots, thus enhancing one or both of their chances of getting elected. But as I said earlier, this is really unprecedented in my experience. I've never seen anything quite like this. We haven't had an open convention in a long, long time, certainly not with the coverage we'll have of this one on social media and on 24/7 coverage. I think maybe in some ways this will be a useful reminder of what self-government looks like and an encouragement for more people to get involved.
How would you characterize your relationship to Senator Cruz?
It's a good working relationship. He and I agree on most things, particularly when it comes to substance. We've had our differences on tactics or how to accomplish those goals. Part of it from the fact that I've been here a while and I'm now part of elected Republican leadership. My goal has always been to figure out how we can be advance the conservative cause, even incrementally at times, when I think he's taken a more immediate, shorter-term view of things. And clearly, he didn't come here to remain in the Senate. He came here to run for president. And I think that's perhaps explained the difference in tactics. But we work together on a regular basis.
Has he asked you for an endorsement?
He has not.
Would you consider it if he did?
I don't really think it's appropriate for me to be picking and choosing in the primaries. One thing, it's pretty dumb politics for a Republican to choose between Republicans in a contested primary, because obviously you're going to be offending some people. And I just think the mood of the country is now that, you know, people don't necessarily want an elected official to tell them how they ought to cast their vote. Matter of fact, it's the opposite. And they want to express themselves, and they have a right to, and I'll respect their choice.
You've been committed to sentencing fraud and criminal justice issues. Can you talk a little bit about what you think needs to change about the way we punish criminals in this country?
Most of my interest and education in the topic of criminal justice reform, I learned from the Texas experience, which is you can try to build your way toward public safety by building more and more and more prisons. The problem is that almost everybody who's in prison gets out of prison at some point. And so just warehousing people in prison is not an answer to them returning to a life of crime and then perhaps returning back through that turnstile back into the criminal justice system. So Texas demonstrated that you can be tough on crime but also smart on crime and provide incentives for inmates to seek to deal with either their educational deficits or their chemical or drug addiction, or otherwise deal or better prepare themselves for reentry into civilized society. At the same time, our recidivism rates come down, our crime rates come down, and we've been able to save money and close prisons. The sentencing reform part is a little trickier, but as you know, in the 90s, there was a much more of an emphasis on longer-term sentencing, stacking sentences, three strikes and you're out. And I think we sort of evolved in this position that long sentences were the most important thing. I think most people who follow this topic would tell you that the certainty of punishment is much more important than the length of the punishment.
We're sitting here in your office in the Senate, the Hart Senate office building. You don't have a great view out your window, but you do have, I see on the wall, looks like a ZZ Top guitar in front of some bookends with Abraham Lincoln on them.
Doesn't everybody have one? the story on the guitar was when President George W. Bush was inaugurated, they had a party and ZZ Top played. And one of my friends in the Texas legislature had the idea, well, we're going to give these mementos, these guitars signed by ZZ Top to the people who were involved in the president's election. People like Karen Hughes, Joe Albaugh, Karl Rove, and the like. And lo and behold, after that, I happened to be in his office, and I saw he had another one. I said, is that an extra one? He said, yeah, would you like it? So, sure, and that's how it ended up on my wall. It's a nice conversation piece.
Senator Cornyn, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Up next on Think, Wall Street Journal White House correspondent Colleen McKay-Nelson is just back from traveling with President Obama to Germany, the UK, and Saudi Arabia. We'll talk with her about the trip's diplomatic objectives in Europe and about whether the president was able to pacify Saudi leaders upset about the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act and the Iran nuclear deal. You can follow along with the hashtag ThinkInDC.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. President Obama is just back from a six-day overseas trip with stops in Saudi Arabia, the U.K., and Germany. In a series of meetings some observers are calling damage control, the president worked to ease tensions with Saudi Arabia over the Iran nuclear agreement and efforts in Congress to allow Americans harmed by 9/11 to sue the Saudi government. In the U.K., the president urged citizens to vote to stay in the EU ahead of a June referendum on whether to withdraw from the political and economic union. And in Germany, Mr. Obama emphasized the country's alliance with Germany, where Chancellor Angela Merkel is more supportive of that relationship than many of her constituents, who are angry over U.S. spying within their borders and bothered by what they view as overly combative American foreign policy objectives. Wall Street Journal White House correspondent Colleen McCain-Nelson is also just back from that trip. You may remember her from her years as a political writer for the Dallas Morning News, and she joins us now to offer her insights on what went down. Colleen, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
As I said earlier, you do not look remotely jet-lagged, so thank you for being with us.
Thank you for that, saying that. I'm not sure I believe it, but thank you.
Back on D.C. time. So the president spent 2 hours in a private meeting with King Salman of Saudi Arabia at the start of his trip. How did the Saudis perceive this legislation proposed by Senators Cornyn and Schumer to allow Americans to sue not only the Saudi government, but other foreign governments, and in this case for 9/11 damages?
Right. Well, suffice to say, they were not a fan of this legislation. As you heard Senator Cornyn discussing, they threatened to sell off U.S. holdings if this legislation moved forward. But interestingly, White House officials said after the meeting with the king that it wasn't discussed in the meeting. And so they said that basically everyone in the room knew where the other stood on this, and they said that the fact that Obama had threatened to veto the legislation had sent a signal that they were kind of satisfied with coming from Obama. There wasn't much more to discuss in terms of Congress because Obama doesn't control Congress, and he'd said before going to Riyadh that he would veto the legislation, that he didn't support it. And so even though the Saudis were frustrated with that, they were frustrated with a number of other things that were coming directly from President Obama. So apparently they focused in the meeting on talking to Obama about things that he could control and not about Congress, which he can't control.
The legislation does have bipartisan support. What has the president said in publicly opposing the idea are his most significant concerns?
Well, he's said that he is concerned that this basically could kind of upend the world order in terms of opening the door to other countries retaliating and passing similar laws and opening up U.S. Diplomats, U.S. military personnel, and the U.S. government to similar lawsuits and essentially putting the taxpayers on the hook for all sorts of lawsuits that might come back at the U.S. And so they're not as concerned about just kind of the intricacies of U.S. citizens suing foreign governments. They're concerned about what foreign governments might do in response to that.
Senator Cornyn told us he thought the Saudis were bluffing when they threatened to divest themselves of nearly $1 trillion in U.S. investments. What would that theoretically do to their economy, which is already in rough shape given the price of oil?
Right. It certainly wouldn't be helpful. And you know, it's open to debate whether they're bluffing. But at this point, you noted that there's bipartisan support for this, but there's also bipartisan concern about this legislation just because it has moved quickly. And at one point, it appeared on track for a vote last week, which it seemed that the supporters of the bill wanted to have a vote on it while President Obama was in Saudi Arabia to kind of send a signal while he was there. And you saw folks kind of tap the brakes and say, okay, we need to take a closer look at exactly what the repercussions of this would be, what kind of unintended consequences could result. And so you saw Paul Ryan come out and say, we need to take a closer look at this. We're not sure exactly what would result from this. And also Lindsey Graham, who is a co-sponsor of the bill, actually put a hold on the bill. So they were moving quickly. And even though there are supporters in both parties, eventually some Republicans said, we want to make sure that this isn't going to come back and cause unintended consequences.
So if that legislation were to pass and the president followed through on his pledge to veto it, what does the possibility of an override look like?
That's unclear at this point. I mean, there is strong support. And so it's possible that an override could happen. But again, things have just moved so quickly, and so it's hard to game that out. And it's an open question how far Democrats are willing to go in defying the president. Obviously, you have Chuck Schumer leading this charge. He has a good relationship with the president, but is he willing to go the extra step of not only opposing the president on this, but then trying to override the president's veto? And so we don't know the answer to that yet.
The Saudis are very upset by the U.S.'s nuclear deal with Iran. How did the president couch that agreement in his discussion with Saudi leaders?
Well, that was one on a long list of grievances from the Saudis. And so President Obama's message was pretty direct to the Saudis and other Arab allies at these meetings and at the summit. And he basically said that he understands their distrust, their mistrust of the Iranians, but that he thinks that the way to deal with that is to have kind of a dual track. And he said we need to have a strong defense, and we also need to have a dialogue. And he said, we understand that this is an existential threat for you, and this is not as much for the United States. But he said things aren't going to get better if you just isolate them. We've all tried isolating them. That didn't work. And so you need to be prepared to have a strong defense, but you also need to look for opportunities to engage with them. And so he continued to push that message, which has not resonated with the Saudis and with other Arab allies. But he continued to stick with that message while he was there.
Colleen, what would be the most significant consequences of a significantly cooler relationship with Saudi Arabia?
Well, there would be a lot of different consequences, and at this point we're kind of like feeling our way around that, and so there are all sorts of different tensions right now, and you see the Iran nuclear deal causing problems. You also see lower oil prices causing issues and kind of portending a showdown on that front. And so this is kind of uncharted territory. And White House officials will say that this has been a little bit overblown. They said, there may be some frustration on both sides here, but there have always been challenges in the region. And so they say, there were challenges in the Middle East before Obama came to office. There will be challenges in the Middle East after he leaves office. This is not all that different. And so they would argue that we're not at a significantly more dramatic point. But it is a tense moment, and Obama has certainly exacerbated that in some ways. Something that did not kind of set up this meeting well was the fact that an interview that Obama gave to The Atlantic magazine came out a few weeks before he went on this trip. And in that interview, he said a lot of disparaging things about our allies. And in that interview, a conversation that Obama had with another foreign leader was recounted where the leader asked Obama, "Aren't the Saudis your friends?" And he said, "It's complicated." Hmm. And he also talked about his frustration with what he called free riders and talked about countries he sees as not pulling their weight, and pointed directly at the Saudis and other allies in this region. So that did not portend for a really positive back and forth at this summit.
Is it your sense that this president or any president is simply more able to be candid about these things now that we've entered a moment when U.S. oil producers not only have the capacity to export U.S. oil, but have ample supply to do so?
Right. It's certainly easier to speak your mind when that's the scenario. I think it's a combination of both that and also just seeing a president in the eighth year. And so as Obama kind of embarks on what essentially are a series of farewell tours, these are, everywhere we go with Obama around the world, it's probably the last time that we're going to these places. And so that was likely Obama's last trip to Saudi Arabia, perhaps his last trip to the Middle East as president. It was likely his last trip to UK, likely his last trip to Germany. And so he's kind of saying some of the things that perhaps he wanted to say sooner. And he feels a little freer to be blunt in his eighth year. And he has said as much. And so what you saw him going to the UK and wading into British politics and telling Britons that they shouldn't leave the European Union, and which a lot of people were surprised by. They viewed it as meddling. And that was just kind of one more example of Obama feeling free at this point to say what he actually thinks.
I've wondered about that. I mean, it's exactly what David Cameron, Prime Minister David Cameron, is saying, although he authorized the referendum that's happening in June. How much do people in the UK care what President Obama has to say about their membership in the EU?
Well, Obama is popular there, so he could be helpful, but he also really stirred up those who are arguing that Britain should leave the EU. And so you saw kind of a furious response while he was there. And so the open question before he arrived was exactly how far would Obama go in expressing his opinion? Because his opinion wasn't a secret. He had given an interview to the BBC a year ago and pretty much laid out his position on that and he hadn't wavered from that sense. But it was different to go to London and stand on British soil and make this argument 2 months before the referendum. And Obama and previous U.S. presidents have very resolutely said, we're not going to get involved in other countries' elections. And so Obama would never go to a foreign country 2 months before an election to elect a leader. And so one could argue that this election, that this referendum is more consequential than your average election for prime minister. And so the question was, how aggressive was he going to be? And leading up to this, the White House said, well, he's not going to give a speech about Brexit, which is the exit from the European Union. He's not going to give a speech about this. But if asked, he'll answer. But then when we got there, he went further than that. He didn't give a speech. But when we woke up Friday morning in London, he had an op-ed in one of the newspapers there, very aggressively making this argument. And then later that day, he gave a press conference with David Cameron. All of the questions, nearly all of the questions centered on that. And he was not only very direct about this, but he also warned Britain that if they left the European Union, that the U.S. may not be willing to do a bilateral trade deal with the U.K. for quite some time. And he said, we're going to be focused on doing a trade deal with the EU. And so Britain would go back to the end of the line. He said the end of the queue. And if you leave the European Union. So it was a pretty aggressive move. And it spurred a furious response. You saw Boris Johnson, the mayor of London, write his own op-ed while Obama was there and really punch back at him. And that's the op-ed where he suggested that because Obama is, in his words, part Kenyan, that he was kind of ancestrally predisposed to trying to undercut Britain.
That was those were very surprising remarks. Are those remarks now being debated within Britain for the, it sounds very much like racist content within them?
Those kind of landed with a thud. I'm not sure if Boris Johnson wanted to take that back, but that probably didn't help his case. And he also raised this kind of bizarre story that has been circulating for several years about Obama removing the bust of Winston Churchill from the Oval Office, which is a story that surfaced several years ago and had been disproven and walked back in different ways over the years. And Boris Johnson put it in his op-ed and said that was just one more example of why President Obama clearly does not like the UK. And so President Obama went so far as to punch back at Boris Johnson in the press conference and tell this long story about how he has a bust of Winston Churchill, not in the Oval Office, but outside his own private office in the residence, and how he walks by it every day. And when he goes into his private office to watch basketball games, which he does quite a bit, he always sees the Winston Churchill bust. And then he talked about how when he took office, there are only so many spots in the Oval Office for busts to sit on, and otherwise it might look cluttered. And he felt like, as the first black president, it would be a good idea to have a bust of Martin Luther King Jr. in the Oval Office. And so at this point, there's a bust of Martin Luther King Jr. in the Oval Office and Winston Churchill outside of Obama's private office. So it was kind of an extraordinary move. You could tell that Boris Johnson had gotten under the president's skin because he took so much time to explain all of his thinking about Winston Churchill and the bust that used to be in the Oval Office.
What does the polling look like in the UK on the referendum question?
it is a dead heat at this point. And it seemed early on that that David Cameron and the folks who want to remain in the European Union were likely to succeed. But we're kind of in this moment, both in the U.S. And in Europe, where you see populism, where you see frustration with institutions. And so with that in mind, the campaign pushing to exit the European Union is really gaining steam at this point. And so all the polls show it being too close to call, and the fact that the Brexit, the Leave campaign is gaining momentum is a concern. So you've seen a lot of activity in the last couple of weeks with studies coming out showing how much it would cost each individual Briton if, in terms of just their own pocketbooks, if Britain indeed left the UK, left the European Union. And you see a lot of folks, you know, issuing these kind of dire warnings, and including President Obama. But it's not clear what's going to happen. This could go either way at this point.
How collegial is the relationship between President Obama and Prime Minister Cameron?
They seem to be quite the buddies. And President Obama kind of notoriously does not have close relationships with a lot of foreign leaders. But he and David Cameron seem to have a very genuine friendship. And so it was on evidence, it was on full display when he was there during their press conference. They both regaled each other with tales reflecting on when they had gone to a basketball game together in the U.S. They talked about how they once played ping pong together. And then perhaps the most extraordinary part of our stop in London was the fact that President Obama actually played golf with David Cameron on Saturday afternoon. And it was interesting because President Obama hates to play golf with other politicians, and
because he doesn't want to lose or win.
I think mostly he considers his time on the golf course, and he does spend a lot of time on the golf course, as his time, and he doesn't want to think about politics. He doesn't want to kind of ruin a pleasant game of golf with having to try to cut deals or, you know, convince Republicans to work with him on something. And so he nearly always plays golf with a very small group of White House aides and or friends from his personal life. And so he really he never does the, you know, reach out and invite the House Speaker for a round of golf. But he played a round of golf with David Cameron, spent the whole afternoon with him, and then went to a dinner with David Cameron that evening. So they had quite the buddy day on Saturday.
We're speaking this hour with Colleen McCain-Nelson, White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and former political writer for the Dallas Morning News. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can follow along on social media using the hashtag Think in DC.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and we're talking politics this hour with Wall Street Journal White House correspondent Colleen McCain-Nelson. Over the weekend, the Think production team visited the Capitol steps and asked people what was on their minds during this election year.
My name is Alvin Green, and I'm from Memphis, Tennessee. Well, you know, the economy is not as good, you're doing as good as it should be. A lot of things is because the Congress don't want to do what they need to do to help the common people.
My name is Jacqueline Franco, and I'm from Brazil. My number one concern is that with the critical time we live in nowadays, if someone like Donald Trump wins, it's going to bring more hate.
My name is Abdelghani Bensala. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, but originally from Algeria, so foreign policies. We just like government to fight the real terrorism, basically by ISIL and all this type of terrorism. That's the main concern for me.
My name's Gina O'Hannison. I'm from New Britain, Connecticut. In a strange way, freedom of speech right now is being inhibited. So in the name of freedom of speech, people are actually inhibiting freedom of speech for people. That's my main concern.
My name is Wesley Rogerson. I'm from Ashburn, Virginia. Yeah, I feel like there's just a lot of political divide on the Democratic side about how progressive we should be. And for me, that's really disconcerting because although we've seen candidates like Bernie Sanders push front runners like Hillary Clinton's agenda being a little bit more progressive, I don't think it's the type of change that my generation expects.
My name is Edwin Schultz, and we're from Lubbock, Texas. Oh, that whoever's going to be president pulls us together. We've got to have someone that can pull the whole country together.
That was a variety of people speaking with Think producers Stephen Becker and Jeff Whittington on the Capitol steps. I'm speaking this hour with Colleen McCain-Nelson, who is White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and you may remember her as a former political writer for the Dallas Morning News. Colleen, you have to sort of keep a sense in your mind of what regular people are thinking, but you're mostly reporting on the people who are actually making policy. How do you balance those two things?
Well, that's a great question because you do exist in kind of covering the White House. You do exist in kind of this weird bubble where you're talking to White House officials and you're talking to members of Congress, and you too seldom are talking to real people. And so and D.C. is a place that is filled with lots of people who aren't necessarily real people who are focused on the business of government and lobbying and all the kind of attendant things that go along with that. And so thankfully, elections come along, and I've been covering the campaign, and it's great to go out on the campaign trail and talk to voters and really go to candidates' events and get a sense of what voters are thinking about and what brings them, what compels them to support different candidates. But it is something you definitely have to keep in mind and find ways to reach out to people outside the D.C. Beltway and get past just kind of what is D.C. speak, where everyone is using the same set of talking points from, you know, each side of the aisle.
I want to know what it's like as a journalist traveling with the president. I've seen journalists do this in TV shows and movies, but I have not done it myself. Is your access different when you are on one of these trips?
It is a little bit better when you're on one of these trips. It's not like you're sitting at the bar having a beer with Obama with President Obama at the end of the day. But by virtue of the fact that you're all traveling together to these foreign countries, you do have more access to White House officials. You do sometimes have access to President Obama. And so when we travel, the president always has a small press pool with him. And so there are 13 members of the press pool, and then there's a larger press corps. And so each reporter on the trip takes turns being in the press pool. And when you're in the press pool, you're with Obama wherever he goes. You're on Air Force One. There's a press cabin on Air Force One. And so when you're in the press pool, you're in close proximity to the president pretty much all the time, which is interesting. And also on these trips, President Obama sometimes will come back to the press cabin and talk to the reporters at the end of a trip and just kind of off the record reflect on the trip and kind of the issues of the day. And so he doesn't wander into the press room at the White House on a regular basis and speak to us. And so you do have a little bit more access on these trips, and you also kind of get interesting insights just by virtue of traveling with the president and his staff and being in close proximity.
When he's off the record, is he inclined to be more candid than, in my experience, elected leaders are wont to be in interviews?
He is more candid to some degree. I will say that I've been in off-the-record conversations with him where he has said what I think are really interesting things that seem very candid at that moment. And then sometimes he'll say the exact same thing on the record a couple weeks later. And so sometimes it seems like he's kind of testing out an idea in off-the-record conversations. So you'll hear it for the first time off the record, and then it will surface later on the record. But there certainly are things that he will say off the record that never turn up in on-the-record conversations. And also you've seen him sometimes say some things in off-the-record conversations that have a way of making their way into stories, which infuriates the White House. And so at one point a couple years ago, Obama said in an off-the-record conversation to reporters, he explained his foreign policy doctrine basically as don't do stupid stuff, except he didn't say stuff.
Right.
And then that turned up in a news story pretty quickly afterwards. And so that really frustrates the White House, that angers the president and makes him less inclined to have off-the-record conversations with White House reporters.
In your turn in the press pool on this recent trip, you were with him, I gather, at the palace in Riyadh.
I was. It was fascinating. So we flew overnight from D.C. and landed in Riyadh and went straight, pretty much straight to the palace after an overnight flight. And the palace was a thing to behold. The security, as you might imagine, was stunning. And this, I mean, we're traveling with the president, who was obviously under very tight security, but the palace took it to a new level. And so we went through a series of gates with very heavy security. And then we passed through one gate and we passed through another gate. And with every passing gate, there were more police officers and more kind of tactical units. And as we got closer to the palace, there were these tactical units with everyone in black with these long, long weapons and their faces even covered with black kind of ski masks and very intimidating looking. And then the palace was as opulent and ornate as you could possibly imagine, with just amazing crystal chandeliers hanging everywhere, elaborate artwork of all these Saudi leaders hanging on the walls. And so the president and the king kind of strolled through the corridor with us trailing behind them and the two of them chatting. And it was fascinating to take in the scene. And so we were in Riyadh for 2 days and we were at the palace, and then we, you know, overnight we were at a hotel, and then there was a summit the next day. And the other White House reporters and I were talking as we left Riyadh that in those 2 days between going to the bilateral meeting with the king and going to the summit and going to the hotel, we never saw a Saudi woman. Everywhere we went, we only saw men. And so the staff at the hotel were only men. The staff at the palace were only men. At the summit, we only saw men. In kind of the bubble that we existed in, we saw not a single Saudi woman.
That has to be strange to think about, it has to. Does it sort of get your emotions up to realize that?
It does. It's difficult to go to some of these other countries, and obviously you need to abide by their laws and their rules, but they're tough to swallow in some cases. And also they kind of put you on edge because you don't want to end up in a Saudi prison. And so, you know, just going and filling out the paperwork, you sign all of these things saying, I understand that if I, you know, bring drugs or alcohol into the country, it could be punishable by death. And the White House send you all these warnings about, you know, having a scarf with you at all times to cover your head, and don't bring anything that is not consistent with their standards of decency. So they said, don't put a Vogue magazine in your bag because that's not consistent with their standards. And so, I mean, on the one hand, you're just a little bit nervous about breaking the rules. But on the other hand, it's stunning to go to a country where these are, in fact, the rules and where you go everywhere and you only see men working and you don't see women in positions of power, or women even just in positions of not power, but just doing everyday jobs.
Certainly, heads of state are on their best behavior in these situations. But were you able to get a sense of the president's relationship to King Salman?
It certainly wasn't a buddy relationship as with David Cameron. They seem to have a polite and cordial relationship. I think it's always a little bit tougher when they're talking through translators, and so it's just a little more formal. By all accounts, their conversation was a pretty frank conversation. It seems like they're willing to be fairly honest with each other. There wasn't a lot of confrontation. It's not as if the king was visibly frustrated with Obama. The White House called it a clearing of the air. And so apparently some frustrations were discussed, but in a polite way. So they seem to have a reasonably good working relationship, but certainly not a close relationship.
Some people have reported on the fact that the king did not meet the president at the airport.
Right. So this was an interesting moment. Air Force One landed in Riyadh, and I was on Air Force One, and we get off the plane, and on the schedule it had said there would be an arrival ceremony. And usually when the president travels abroad, arrival ceremonies are pretty elaborate, and there are bands and, you know, just all the national anthems and a big to-do. And this was very understated. They had rolled out a single red carpet. Obama walked down the steps, and he stood on the red carpet, and there were a few Saudi officials there to meet him, probably half a dozen, but the king was not there. And so President Obama spent a couple minutes speaking with these other officials, and then he walked to his helicopter and he got on Marine One and left. In the meantime, the king was at another airport just a couple hours earlier greeting all of the Arab leaders who were arriving. And so basically the king's MO is that he always meets Arab leaders who are arriving. He sometimes meets other leaders, but he doesn't always meet them. He chose not to meet President Obama. When I spoke to White House officials about this, they said that they thought this was a little bit overblown. They weren't really too bothered by this. They said that the president is not really into all this pomp and circumstance. That's not something he's focused on. And that's true. Obama doesn't really obsess about those things. And so the White House didn't seem terribly troubled by it, but it certainly became an issue in news coverage. And it was noted everywhere that the king chose not to greet President Obama at the airport.
While in Germany, the president announced plans to send as many as 250 additional U.S. service members to Syria. I think there are like 50 there now. Granted, it's a big increase in percentages, but it doesn't sound like a whole lot of people. What will their orders be?
Well, their orders will be these are not combat forces. They're not going to be on the front lines. Ben Rhodes, the president's deputy national security advisor, said these personnel will be combat equipped, and it's possible that they will be in harm's way because it's a dangerous place. But their mission is to assist local forces, to train and assist local forces, which is the same mission as the 50 U.S. personnel who are there now. And so it's not a change in strategy, but it's notable because the president has been so loath to have boots on the ground. And we can argue about whether these are in fact boots on the ground since they're not on the front lines, but they are combat equipped and they're in it, and they many of them are special operations forces. And so the president drew such a stark line on that. And so he has kind of been inching toward doing this. And he first sent 50 there, and now he is sending 250 more. And they say that the reason is because they sent 50, they said that they subsequently saw a lot of progress in terms of pushing back Islamic State militants. And so they say this is something that's working, so we should do more of it. And so they will deploy these 250 more U.S. personnel in phases, and they will send them there with the same mission with the hope of pushing back Islamic State and making more progress.
There are people who really don't follow global politics closely who are aware that the president met with Prince George.
Indeed. For some people, that was the highlight of the trip. And so on Friday evening, the president and the first lady went to Kensington Palace. They went there for dinner with Prince William, Kate, and Prince Harry. And we were told over and over again that the children would not be involved, that we would not see the children. And so I was with the president for this, and we were standing in a courtyard at Kensington Palace when the president pulled up in his car. President and the first lady got out of the car, and Prince William and Kate and Prince Harry came outside to meet them. And it was cold and it was raining and it was kind of awkward. We're all standing in the rain, and President Obama is holding an umbrella trying to keep everyone dry while they all exchange pleasantries. And so they paused for a couple and took a couple photos, allowed the journalists to take a few photos, and then they turned to go inside Kensington Palace, and they opened up the doors. And when they did, I had a direct line and could see straight into the palace, and standing near the door was Prince George. And who's 2 years old. And amazingly, he was standing there in quite this elaborate nighttime attire. He was wearing these gingham pajamas, and then he had this white monogrammed robe on over his pajamas. It was quite an ensemble for a 2-year-old at bedtime. And so I had a very clear view of him. And then subsequently, they had dinner and cocktails and played with Prince George. They even brought out the rocking horse that President Obama had given as a gift for his birth, and had Prince George ride it to prove, see, we really like your rocking horse.
Colleen McCain-Nelson is White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and former political writer for The Dallas Morning News, just back from covering President Obama's 6-day international tour. Colleen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
This was fabulous. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and executive producer Jeff Whittington. Our team back in Dallas-Fort Worth includes Shelley Canavy, Stephanie Kuo, and Gus Contreras. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.